Well, hello. On Tuesday, February 28th, 2012, you're listening to Brian and Gabe and Jack and Ron live.
That's the energy that you were missing last week, man. Are you having a better day?
I had to make up for it.
We're doing good.
And back down to normal.
Well, I just found, for those people from San Francisco, there's actually a little kiosk that sells blue bottle coffee on my way from the subway to the office. And blue bottle coffee will change your life when it comes to coffee. I used to have to go out of my way for it, but now that I can drink blue bottle, it's really, really awesome. I wonder if they would give us free coffee for that.
Is that like a brand or something out there?
Yeah, and it's one of these things where it's locally roasted, but they roast the beans, like I guess regular beans, they roast them so they have a really long shelf life, and these they don't roast them as much. So the beans, if you buy a bag of beans, only lasts like 2 weeks. But it's amazing. It's so it tastes like coffee. Like, I feel like coffee smells amazing but tastes like shit a lot of times. And this tastes as good as it
smells.
But
weren't you just telling me last weekend about how the blue bottle people like frou-frou'd you because you use a drip coffee maker?
Yeah, I was asking about some flavor or something like that. What's this like? And they asked, how I do it, how I make it. And I mentioned it's automatic drip, and they definitely gave me the eye roll, like, you know, I was putting some Sam's Club tires on their M5, you know?
Like, how dare you grind up beans and pour hot water through it, right?
Yeah. Oh, man. Well,
and other parts of the world right now are looking at us and going, this is your problems?
FML, man.
Always have to bring it down.
Well, I love that Billy Crystal from the Oscars, the one line he had, which I love, is, you know, nothing buoys American spirits by than watching an evening full of millionaires giving each other gold statues.
You know, last week I tweeted something that said something like, you know, if you buy Angry Birds with Verizon on a Verizon Android phone, do you still have to buy it if you have a Sprint Android phone? And Kevin Goodman tweeted something along the lines of, the problems of a first world country.
So Ron, we're glad that I think this is your first time joining us on this version of our show. I know we've been doing podcasts kind of on and off for years, and I remember we did some podcasts at Bryform 2006 and you were there. Ron, of course, probably most people know, but he is one of the 10-time Bryform speakers. I'm holding up your bobblehead in front of the camera. Actually, we should have. I don't know if you got a video feed, Ron. If not, we're putting the picture of the bobblehead.
Did we even mention that these are available on YouTube now?
Oh, yeah. These shows.
Not the bobbleheads.
Are available on YouTube. Oh, yeah. The video shows are available on YouTube now. So this is our, you know, if you want to watch it later and see what we look like. It's very exciting to watch us sit around with headphones on and talk to each other.
I actually, and the shame is, I actually think I'm going to miss the Bryform Europe this year. I'm like so swamped with everything, you know, I've got going on, and I didn't have time to really come up and think of a, you know, new and exciting topic, so I didn't want to burn any of your cycles this year. So I think this might be the first one I've missed since, you know, way back in Washington, D.C.
You got your 10, you're out.
I got my 10 and out, right? Yeah.
Well, I will tell you that we, should you want to, I know, you know, creating a session takes a lot of effort also, so I don't want to sort of put that on you. But I feel confident that we can say that anyone who's spoken at every single Bryform, you're allowed to have your own deadline for submitting sessions. So I feel like that's I feel like that's fair. Plus, you know, it's Bryform and I'm Ryan, so.
Well, I'll think about it some. This last month was like crazy for me, but I'll give it some thought. Maybe I've got something cool that I've been doing internally that might be interesting. You know, my latest things have been burning down for some of our customers has been burning down a bunch of these hardware vendors when they come out with those, you know, oh, I got 9 billion users on this server, and trying to educate them. I'm like, yeah, they ran, you know, Notepad or something. And I've been burning it down, especially with some of the hardware vendors, because I've had access to that type of hardware and I've been able to run like login VSI and run real tests and show that. But I don't know, you know, Ruben and those guys and your own have that pretty nailed down. So I'll give it some thought.
Let me ask
you. What do you see? I was trying to put together a presentation just for something that we're doing. And I see these, all the the estimations of what how many IOPS a Windows 7 box can do. So, and they have them these generalized things like task worker, power user, you know, and then like I forget what the other one was, but 20 IOPS is the max that Windows 7 says it can have. And I feel like when you start generalizing things that much, you're asking for a lot of damn trouble.
Yeah, that's all bullshit. The whole 20 IOP thing, right? What they're doing is, and some of that's based on some of the original work from Ruben and your own, mm-hmm. and them kind of, they have to generalize so people can wet their thumb and stick it in the air and say, okay, I need about this much, so a starting point. You know, the reality is, though, is, and it was great that you guys, that Brian, you guys put up the beverages statistical math for VDI, because he hit it dead on the center, right? So a VDI instance might use, let's say, for a heavy worker, 20 IOPS. What's the standard deviation for that, right?
And it's where probably huge, right? At logging, he's probably using 1,000 IOPS. You know,
it's enormous. It's enormous. Yeah. I mean, if it only had 20 IOPS, no one would ever need an SSD in their laptop. But we all know that when we slam an SSD in our laptop, it rocks.
Right.
That's amazing. Like there's a tweet right there. I mean, that sums up the IOPS. Yeah. Brilliant.
So yeah, I guess, is that still the baseline that people are using when they're trying to figure this stuff out? Or I guess that gets you there. Should you just like take whatever you figure out for 20 IOPS per power user and then double it or triple it or quadruple it? I mean,
yeah, I think that
or should you just abandon it?
I think that people need a starting point to at least say what type of disk do I need. So mm-hmm. so let's use 20 as an example for a second. If they take the number of active sessions that they're thinking per host and they multiply it by 20 and they come up with, you know, something simple, 800 IO with some type of read write pattern, they can at least say, okay, I can get X number of disk and I'll be kind of in that range. Whereas if they took that same number and you know, they talked to Cisco and some sales rep told them they were going to get, you know, 279 sessions on this Cisco blade that can only contain two drives, and they go,
right.
Yeah, there's no way I can do it there. I have to move up. I think the real IO problem, and it's funny, you know, three years ago now when I started at Unidesk, Chris, the CTO, and I were talking about this IO issue. And for a while, we were really getting pushed by people inside the company and people outside of the company to go do a boatload of memory caching to solve the IO problem. And Chris and I over, you know, nights and beers just kept saying, this is a hardware problem that we brought on ourselves by demanding cheap disk space.
You mean
that's going to be solved? Chris Midgley, right. From Unidesk. Yeah. That's going to be solved on the hardware side. And now 2 years later, you can see, you know, whether it's kind of low-end disk, like, you know, and I hate to call it low-end disk because I actually like the stuff, but less expensive disk like Equalogic with their XVS, where they're dynamically moving data into SSD that needs to be there and using some of the SSD for a write cache, mm-hmm. or whether it's the big EMC shops with, you know, fast cache and all that. Problems being solved on the hardware, you know, throw some SSD at it to use in the appropriate places and then dump all that other stuff off on spindles, you know.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that, and there's a lot of all-in-one products that are coming out that are kind of niche or very specialized. Zio, you know, for instance, I think is doing that. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, they're doing it in 3U chassis that are just for, well, they market it towards desktop virtualization, but they're for all sorts of other applications too. But at least they're not giant, huge boxes of iron sitting in the data center.
The real problem we're seeing now that no one's really talking about, I mean, I've had a couple of tweets on it and people have responded, but the real problem that no one's really talking about is the enormous amounts of effing data that we're throwing on centralized disk, which I don't care what it is, it's more expensive than local disk, that's completely useless. I had a customer I was talking to on Friday last week that I was trying to basically show him ways to get around this problem, but he has a bunch of engineering students, like you know, 1,000 of them. It's a technical school. Their students do everything from app development to, you know, like, you know, how to design a bridge and crap like that. So all of his machines require 4 gig. And he's sitting there figuring out all this math, and he figured out that, you know, it should have hit him earlier, but if he figured out that every machine by default is going to get a VSWAP file that's 4 gig large, Windows will default to a 4 gig page file, but he's going to reduce it to 2. But if he's got 1,000 users, he's got over 6 terabytes of page files
just on his centralized storage.
Yeah.
And he told me right up, he goes, look, I already bought 3 of these XVS arrays, and now I'm having to look at buying one of these non-hybrid, just rotating big 14 terabyte things. He goes, if I would have known I was putting 6 terabytes of page file on this, I would have threw this shit in the trash before I ever started. And the hardware vendors, EMC and NetApp, aren't going to tell you that, right? That up to 50% of your space is going to be page file hitting your disk. But I think that when you talk to some of these other vendors that have servers and are willing to look at, can I leverage local disk? Can we start to put this transient type crap data on local disk to keep the cost down? That you get a little more of a responsive ear than when you're talking to the guy at EMC.
Yesterday I had a couple beers with these guys from a company I'm going to mispronounce. I want to say Tegile. It's T-E-G-I-L-E. I wanted to say Tegile.
I'm going to go Tegile.
Tegile.
And he says we pronounce it like with a southern drawl. And I would say, oh, you mean Tegile. The Tegile. But he says something like Tegile. Do you know these guys, Ron?
No, I haven't heard of them.
Okay, so I never heard of them either. They make a hardware appliance for storage. And it's kind of like what the vision is from Extreme IO that they announced like a year ago and still haven't. Well, I guess they never really announced it. I kind of like, to be fair, like pried it out of them. I think, but where
they still sponsored Bryform and didn't tell us why. You know, they didn't share what the product was, but they were still out there.
Yeah, and I guess they anyway, it's this inline. Block level single instant storage. So they are primary storage, and they have, you know, NFS or iSCSI or fiber or whatever you want. And they can have random blocks with no hints, completely unstructured, just random blocks of data come in. And when they see duplicates, they're going to be able to, you know, only store one instance of the duplicate, which means that a lot of that stuff goes into memory and into SSD. Where these guys are kind of amazing, and the folks that started this company, this is their third startup. The first two they built and sold, so they're like, it's like the like Chris, I guess, also, and Don and those guys. But so the thing is, what's crazy about first of all, the pricing, their box, their entry level box is $16,000, but that gives you 10 terabytes of usable storage. And this is not to mention the fact that by the time you have all this, you know, inline sort of single instance, it might be the equivalent of, you know, huge amounts. Yeah. And the other thing is they have 140 of these boxes in production among different customers now. So I wonder if that is kind of like this holy grail that I wanted, because, you know, I've talked a lot about this before. When I want VDI to be persistent images, because I don't want to make people jump through all these hoops and have to contort themselves to make all the layering stuff work, though I want to talk to you about that today, Ron. And so these, I mean, it seems super awesome, but I never even heard of these guys. You know, I think they've been selling their products for 6 months, and I guess I don't know if anyone else has has heard of them. I guess not you guys on the phone anyway, but I guess we'll look into that. So I guess that leads us to the next thing. So my view of VDI is that I want VDI to be persistent, so my users can continue to be local admins, so I can continue to install whatever software I want, so the users can install whatever they want. And basically that allows me to take my existing desktop framework, structure management, et cetera, and drop that into the data center for those scenarios where I need data center-based desktops. And so I'm curious, Ron, on your thoughts on that.
No, I agree with the persistent model, right? Obviously, I think that, I tend to think that in order to make the persistent model really viable to someone, they'll say, okay, well, why would I centralize it if I'm going to patch the same way or distribute apps the same way? It's sometimes easy to do that. The thing that keeps the persistent model from really working, you hit on it a little bit with the storage, is that it's storage, right? I mean, no one's willing to pay 40, 50 gig, 30 gig, maybe even on the smaller side, per desktop on some centralized expensive storage. You know, it's they're just not willing to do it. EMC would love that. So the trick is you got to shrink the storage down. Now maybe it's inline dedupe or some other model like that. I mean, I tend to still like the image sharing model that'll give you a persistent, whatever that is, right? Whether it's, you know, hey, I've got provisioning server and I dropped RingCube on top of it, or I have Unidesk and I'm sharing layers, but I have persistence or whatever. Because I think there's more of a benefit there on the management side. You know, I mean, it's so funny. I'm not going to say who I was talking to. I was talking to this person at Microsoft 2 weeks ago where they're, certain groups are trying to wrap their hands around what do we do with VDI, right? And, you know, the honest answer there was so funny. She goes, no one here knows anything outside of their silo. So if I go and I talk to the management guys and I say, look, we got to do something different for VDI. We've got to block. And they go, well, you patch with SCCM. And she's like, no, we want to do something different. Do you have any new ideas? And they go, yeah, yeah, patch with SCCM. and she goes, and I go over and I talk to the Hyper-V guys, and I ask them, is there any way we can do this? She goes, yeah, spin up a bunch of full clones, right? So, you know, maybe on their side it's a storage fix. Who knows, right? But I really think that there's two things going on out there. There's the centralization, like you said, and the only way to make that affordable is to get the cost of storage down through, you know, inline dedupe or image sharing or whatever. But I actually think there's a play on the management side too. I just think people are, you know, I think virtualization itself, even if you do full clones like you suggest, helps with patches and stuff installing via traditional method because there's less variation in drivers and OS builds. So you don't have as many failures. But I really think that, you know, you take that from an enterprise where they have packaging specialists and things work, you know, in high 90 percentages to that, you know, that company that's, you know, it's not huge, it's not small, it's 550 seats, it's 1,000 seats. And the guy who's trying to run the patching is also the guy who has to monitor all the servers and make sure, you know, some of the backups were running last night. And they're just looking for a simpler model, I think. And that's why they're going to VDI.
So there's a lot to talk about in there. Let's first look into the, sort of the traditional management. And I guess maybe my world has been sort of enterprise focused for too long because I've always sort of thought when it comes to VDI that if we already have ways of managing our desktops, whether it's SCCM or what have you, that we can just sort of continue to do that within our world of VDI. And sure, and I agree with what you're saying, Ron, that I think we'll have more success with VDI because similar, you know, the driver bases and just the fact that all the users' desktops are in our building, so we don't have to worry about sending out package and wait till Monday to find out if it ran or whatever. But maybe that is an enterprise-focused thing. I don't know. Like, I don't know what the use... I don't know how many companies out there have desktop management like an SCCM or Alteryx. You know, I'm sure probably every sort of large company does, but...
Yeah. Well, we run into... I mean, all the large boys have it. I mean, even if you run into, you know, and let's take the extremes out, right? Take out the, you know, the Goldman Sachs of the world, you know, where they're talking about, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 desktops at a pop.
Yeah, they're like, screw SCCM. That shit's not good enough for us. And
yeah, they're like, we wrote our own shit, you know? Yeah. Screw you guys. And then on the other side, you've got the really small guys, right? Joe's Plumbing Shop in Akron, Ohio, right? The guy has 20 desktops total, and a couple of his guys have laptops for mobile quotes or whatever. But take those, you know, take the in-betweens. And even when you think about government, government's really interesting. And Brian, I know you did a lot of government work when you were at HP back in the day. But, you know, we think of government as, you know, these millions of desktops. But they're all managed by these little groups, right? You go into the military or DODD or you go into the U.S. Census Bureau or you go into any of these things. And they all talk about, I manage my 500, I manage my 1,500 desktops, I manage my 4,000 desktops. And that's where they feel that pain, right? It's all these redundant, you know, they have their own little fiefdom. They can do what they want. They have to live up to certain codes or regs or laws that say what they have to do security-wise or reporting-wise. But, you know, that poor guy, he's got 1,500 desktops to deal with, and then he's got all these other things too. And, you know, quite frankly, you know, you should know, Brian, you were an SMS geek way back in the day. How hard is it to, like, package and become a really good application package or really good at distributing patches, right? It's not an overnight thing in most cases.
Now, on the flip side of that, though, sort of by definition, whatever they're doing now is working because their company's in business, like they have users.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm nervous. One of my big fears about moving to, I guess I could say desktop virtualization, but specifically VDI, is that VDI is such a change just in terms of the general user experience, because you have, you know, you take the desktop away from the user and centralize, and then they have to deal with the different devices and protocols and that kind of stuff. So that's a big change right there. And then at the same time, if we also sort of fundamentally change the way that we're managing desktops, that's a lot to change at once. And my fear is a lot of times VDI projects either get stuck in pilot or fail outright, not because the VDI aspect of it failed, but because this massive change trying to go to whether it's a shared desktop model or something like that, like that's the reason that VDI fails.
Right. So rather than changing it all at once, you can, you know, if you can get your desktops into the data center and deal with that first while still managing it the same way you're currently managing your desktops, then that at least lets you take a phased approach to you know, utter completion, you know, utter VDI bliss, if such thing exists.
Well, and I see, I think you hit on it a little bit, but I would flip it. I would say that there's a lot of people that make the decision to go to VDI, kind of like you were saying, Brian, that there's all these things going on that, you know, which protocol do I use and how do I get them remote access and what happens if the network link is down to this remote site and all that stuff. And I think they go there in almost in spite of that, right? They're looking a lot of times for a new way to patch or manage. You know, I got a customer, he's a smaller customer in San Antonio, about 500, 800 seats, something like that. But he's like 15 locations, right? And it's all these locations with 20 users, 50 users, 80 users. And for him, it was really, I'm sick of driving out to site, whatever, every, you know, 3 days to fix this guy's computer and to do that. So it was really, he was looking for a new way to manage. Now the protocols and thin clients and all the other stuff he had to deal with, I think if he could have managed like he did in VDI, some centralized way, you know, reset desktops, push application, I patch some image and it, you know, I don't have to know how to package, I just patch and it goes out, and he didn't have to VDI it, I think he would have done that, you know. But there's really no good tools that, you know, change the way, there's nothing really that fundamentally has changed the way that we patch Windows, that we update applications or install applications. And I think there are some users that are really looking for that.
Now, in that use case for the San Antonio customer, why not something like a Mocha 5 or Virtual Computer or Winova or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, he would have, and those might have solved his problems. I know that he would have had to bought new hardware and went with a new model, right? Whether it was a Type 1 hypervisor or whatever. He was kind of sold on the idea of bringing as much as he could centrally, buying some servers, spending the money there. And then they do have thin clients, but they also have some repurposed desktops as thin clients. And he went that direction. I mean, maybe a distributed model would have done that. You know, in our case, in his case specifically, most of his desktops aren't even persistent. I would have to say 70-80% of them aren't even persistent. It's vast majority of it for him was application updates, desktop repairs, and desktop patching. So maybe a distributed model, you know, Type 1 hypervisors would have got where we thought they would all be.
I wonder
two
if
or
there's
3 years ago.
If you look at a distributed solution that would maybe require that you refresh your hardware to be able to your end user hardware in order to be able to support you know, Type 2, I wonder what taking into account everything that we say about cost models, I wonder what the cost model of that endpoint refresh looks like versus going with a centralized solution.
Yeah, and I don't know, right? We have to know that you'd have to have decent hardware. You know, it probably wouldn't have to be Rockstar gaming system type hardware to do it. You'd have to have decent hardware to run a Type 1. And we never really know because there haven't been a lot of financial models built around that saying, hey, what's better for me, VDI or the Type 1 distributed with management pieces? Really, because those Type 1s all burn down. When compared to the expectations everyone had for them, they really burned down before anyone got that far. Doesn't Windows 8, who knows, that might change that.
Doesn't VDI burn down before people get too far?
No, VDI just kept kind of smoldering, I would say, right? Like it was like the guy who doesn't know how to start a fire, he throws three logs in a pit and he tosses some gas on it and a match, right? And it flames really big and then it kind of dies down, so he throws more gas on it, right? He just keeps doing that over and over until the logs catch.
So
I watched a guy at a campground do that without the gas.
Regardless, you end up with a pile of ash. Just one of them slowly smoldered while the other one flash fired. So, you know, I wonder, and there's maybe something to be said here also, that if you're going to have to spend the money, maybe there's a perception that doing something that's client-based is the sort of quote-unquote the old way of doing things. I'm not advocating this, by the way. I'm just kind of going through this thought exercise where you say, well, if my use case supports allowing VDI, then I also have the flexibility of users to work from other client devices and pop into any computer on the planet and get their desktop and the central backup and that kind of stuff. So maybe there's something like, okay, so there are good future ways to do distributed managed desktops, and that's a, you know, type one, type two hypervisor on the client, something like that. And there's the VDI way, so maybe there's something to that. Like, well, if I'm going to re-engineer what I'm doing now, maybe I should just go with everything in the data center and kind of say goodbye to the managing these endpoints out there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, endpoint management's always been a pain in the butt. I mean, all the way back to the, you know, the late 90s when, you know, we all thought ASPs would be the end of the world. But what I see is a lot of people, and it's funny because I remember seeing one of your Tech Target spiels a couple of years ago in New York, and one of the things you were harping on, and you probably still do it, it's probably the same spiel, but one of the things you were harping on was VDI. VDI doesn't cost the same as the $300 Dell you shove under your desk, just like, you know, you used to be able to get email in some crappy interface in Windows 3 or Windows 95, but now you get it on a BlackBerry and an iPad, and it does all these other things, so it costs more. You know, that's why we went out and spent a bunch of money on Bez servers back in the day. But I see a lot of people, when I go in and I talk to them about, you know, what are you trying to do, they say that. They say, look, we're gonna build VDI to stop managing these desktops this way. But the cool thing is we're going to start testing remote access and bring your own device and, you know, all these other things. So they're really starting, they think VDI is that stepping stone to allowing them to do that.
And it's interesting though, because they're not, and fundamentally VDI does not remove their need for having to manage instances of Windows. You know, and I think that that's one of the big misconceptions. Maybe Windows becomes easier to manage because, as you said earlier, if they're all VMs, they all have the same sort of core driver set and they're all in their own basement, so they're easy to update and stuff. And I guess fundamentally, you know, I mean, my feeling was always if your VDI environment is able to work off these shared non-persistent models, then maybe you can get some management savings from that, but you still have to deal with applications that are not compatible and user environment and all that kind of stuff. So there's no way you're leaving the world of Windows management.
There's still a lot of Windows in there, that's for sure. I mean, I you would be surprised at the number of calls that I get or the support guys get on basic Windows things. You know, I mean, just, you know, we're Unidesk, right? We're there for their apps and building a desktop, and someone will call up and say, you know, this guy can't do this, and we'll wind up Googling, you know, the error for some Microsoft knowledge base article on, you know, they didn't install something in their Windows package. So they still wind up doing that. I think that VDI without a management system, I mean, think about it. If you had Vue or Zen Desktop with no image sharing, would anybody move to it?
Goldman Sachs.
Well, yeah, but they did their whole weird thing with individual terminal servers and whatnot, right? But yeah, I mean, how many people would be flocking to it if we said, well, here's what you're going to do. You're going to make these things VMs. You're going to run WSUS or SCCM on them, and you're going to have a guy that can package apps over here, and you're going to have this guy that can, you know, some might do it for remote access, you know, kind of along the lines of last week where Claudio was, you know, talking about these people wanted to remote access their desktops. But not a lot, right? A lot of people they're really looking for a different way to update desktops. They're still going to have to update them, but they want to make it simple.
Now,
for sure, if it was that alluring to do persistent stuff, you know, or static images without any other built-in management, everybody would be doing it. But, you know, it's too complex.
Yeah, I mean, people, Yeah, and you know, it was funny. I always talk about Vue Composer because I was, you know, I was at Glasshouse and then Dell, you know, big VMware shops. And I was at a meeting at VMware once where they introduced the concept of Composer before it became an actual product. And the solution was to do two things. And that, you know, we want to reduce the storage footprint and we want to make it so you can patch an image once and push it to everybody. We want to make it so that, you know, you don't have to package a fix. You don't have to use WSUS. You don't have to do any of these things. You patch this image once, you say go, and it goes out. And it does those two things really well, right? I mean, we've seen they had to go out and get an AppVert product, and they had to buy RTO, and they had to do all those things. But that's, you know, that's what they had to do to make people buy VDI, because if you just moved a bunch of thick images centrally, the admin guy didn't see that it made his job any easier from a management perspective.
But now Composer to me seems like the most craziest, well, amongst the crazy products in the world, Composer is there. And this is not, I mean, it's the same with NetApp Flex Clones and I mean, a lot of this kind of stuff, provisioning services, there's, and actually the new Hypercache stuff from Quest Software, which only works, all of these products that require a shared master image, and then they make all these little delta differential files for all the users so they can have the, you know, the personalization that each VM needs to physically like boot up and have a different identity and stuff. But when you update your master and then recompose, you know, you blow away all those settings changes for all those individual users. And so that just goes back to my, you know, one of my arguments I've been giving for a few years. I mean, so Composer only works for non-persistent desktops.
Yep.
So if you're doing all that, I mean, geez, why aren't you just using Terminal Server and doing the whole thing with like 3x the user density?
Which is what I say a lot, right, is that it's great for a non-persistent thing, non-persistent workspace for a user, but because it was built on the block level, everything has, I mean, that think about it, because of the way Composer was designed or any block-based image sharing was designed, you have to go out and get an application tool, a profile tool, AppSense, Res, RTO, you know, whatever it is, or else it's a terminal server with no roaming profiles.
And way more expensive.
And way more expensive, right?
And stupid ass licensing.
And, yeah, and crazy Microsoft licensing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the funny thing is I always start off my presentations when I do demos explaining that to people when I'm just talking about Unidesk, because that's one of the things we didn't actually want to be in the non-persistent business. I was talking to someone yesterday at Unidesk, bringing them up to speed. When we first rolled out the product in beta and version one and whatnot, there was no non-persistent desktop in Unidesk. We're like, well, that's covered. Go buy Terminal Server, go buy Vue. It was later after people bought our system and used it that they said, we want to do this with our non-persistent desktops. Now, while I may think that if a desktop is non-persistent, you should first try it on terminal services and, you know, then use, if a customer tells me he wants to buy a product for non-persistent, we're going to make it for him. But you're dead on. If you can do non-persistent, try RDS first, then move to, you know, a Composer or something like that. And what we found was that they weren't coming to us because, you know, our image sharing was necessarily any better. It was that we didn't do it at the block level. So all those things that you talked about, even our non-persistent desktops, the computer name, the domain SID, all that stuff that happens when a machine is first built are retained. You know, we try not to kill all that stuff that makes a desktop kind of what a desktop is.
Well, so I think you answered a question from earlier, because you mentioned this customer in San Antonio with 70 or 80% of that person's VDI desktops being non-persistent. And I was sort of going to ask you, you know, what the hell?
Yeah. Well, it was kind of twofold. It was about the applications, right? I mean, he tried some thin app. They looked at other things. He never found anything that just worked for him. And of course, you know, for the 20% that were persistent, they needed to be persistent. But the difference with us is that since we're not doing it at the block level, since the OS and the apps and everything is in a layer, essentially, you can retain all that stuff that you were talking about. You can retain the computer name and the domain SID, and, you know, frickin' when Symantec Antivirus boots the first time and it writes a UUID into the registry and registers with the enterprise management server, it all looks and acts like it should, versus, you know, a recompose where essentially the desktops are blown away and recreated with the same name.
So let's talk a little bit. I mean, I know that, so you work at Unidesk, and I know, you know, your presence here on the show is sort of not related to Unidesk, but more of like Ron, the guy who's been in this industry for, I don't know, 10 plus years, 15, whatever it is. And I mean, doing terminal server for 10 years, you know. So I know your background is consulting and been a terminal server kind of VMware guy. You and I wrote a book about terminal server together in 2004. You've since written, what, 2, 3, 4 books on VMware. Mm-hmm. You spent a short time at Dell, but you've been at, you spent a year at Dell. That's sort of first jump on the sort of vendor provider side. Now you've been at Unidesk for come up on 2 years now, right?
Yep. Three. There'll be three in October.
Holy moly.
Is this the longest you've been with a company?
No, I was at RapidApp for 7 years before we got bought by Glasshouse. Yeah. So I'm hoping to get seven here. We'll see.
But kind of fill us in, because I don't know if we've actually talked about Unidesk on BrianMadden.com in the past year or so. And so maybe just kind of give a primer for those listening who are not specifically familiar with Unidesk, but then I want to sort of dig into what's changed since we last talked, and that could have been like a year ago even, I don't know.
Yeah, so we're a layering company, and layering to us and to most people that are really into VDI that pay attention to it is really kind of the next, I would say a guy at VMware told me it was the next gen of what Composer should be like. And instead of doing provisioning and applications and stuff with all these kind of point tools, we start at the OS, and instead of doing, hey, I've got this VMDK and I'm going to share it, so I've got all these Delta disks and it's block level sharing, we do it at the file system and registry level. Essentially layering, whether it's, you know, RingCube or us or whoever, is file system and registry virtualization, the ability to merge those and present them to Windows so it sees a C drive and it sees a registry and it just looks normal. But underneath you have an OS layer that contains all of its file system and objects and registry entries. You have application layers that might have been built on top of the OS layer, but they're unique. They only contain their file system objects and registry entries. And then each desktop has a personalization layer that contains the things that get changed for that desktop, whether it's a profile change, whether it's a programmatic change from like antivirus, right? Pushing out a UUID to the machine. Or whether it's a user-installed app. And what we do is we replace those tools, like in a VMware environment, we would replace Composer. In most cases, we would replace ThinApp. And then, of course, you wouldn't need roaming profiles or RTO or anything, because we could provide persistent desktops that are sharing images and can be single image updated and all that crap, right?
So the idea or the goal of layering is the sort of user experience of persistent desktops, where a user makes a change, installs an app, what have you, and it sticks until next time they're there. But with the sort of management simplicity and storage efficiencies of this shared non-persistent desktop.
Yeah. It's kind of a merging of stateless and stateful environments.
Wanted shared image VDI to be. You know,
yeah, exactly. You know, we get a lot of people to ask us about that. Now, we're going to try to take it to the next step, and we get a lot of people asking us to do some other things. But I always tell people, and I used to tell this during my demo, but I didn't come to Unidesk because of VDI. And when they first reached out to me, our chief marketing officer, Tom Rose, reached out to me a couple times. I actually blew him off. I was like, I'm not all that into VDI. Whatever, dude. You know, it's centralized desktops. But it was when I talked to Chris, the CTO, and we really dug into the technology, and one slide he showed me the concept of, okay, if I separate these things into logical items that we can then manage independently, and I do this stuff with the user personalization layer, where I can actually control some of the data and where it lands, and the cool thing about it is I can do repairs. And he showed me the concept of, what if I had a central Windows 7 image or a central set of applications that I could push to VDI, and I could push that same image down to a desktop, and it ran there? This, is, of course, was when we all thought Type 1 hypervisors were right around the corner. Now I've got an IT platform where I can manage desktops, laptops.
Do we lose
the central VDI images? The application packages are all the same. It won't have the list of advert because we can do application of advert because we can do drivers and all that stuff. And by the way, if someone toasts a laptop, you hit, you know, rollback, and it takes them back to yesterday in their personalization layer. So that's, you know, that's kind of why I went here, was because of the layering technology, not necessarily because of VDI.
So is that still in the cards as far as the desktop management, even on the physical side, even in light of the fact that Type 1 hypervisors never took off?
Yeah, it's still something we want to do and we talk about all the time. Generally, the discussions are around, you know, what platform does it land on? Because we're not in the business of making our own Type 1 or anything like that. You know, Windows 8 change that, you know, with its own built-in Hyper-V, maybe? Is it the right platform? Will the SDK and everything be there for us to automate it and do what we need to do? Who knows, right? It's not even there yet.
Because fundamentally, the Unidesk layering, that's happening at the hypervisor level. So it's the hypervisor doing all this magic of melding all these sort of different disk images together.
Kind of. It's above that. So all the VM sees is disks attached. The actual merging of the disks is happening from within the drivers. We call it the CFS, the composite file system, that actually merges it. So, you know, a little trick, you could actually go into a Unidesk desk and list the disk volumes, and you can see multiple disk volumes. But if you just go to Windows Explorer and double-click on the C drive, all you see is a C drive. So it's actually kind of happening below the executing environment at the driver level, but above the hypervisor. So we can actually run our stuff on almost anything. You know, hypervisor-wise, we just have to write to their SDK to do copy files and stuff like that.
There's a bunch of questions that are coming in, and we'll get through these, but I'll interject one that, so you're mentioning hypervisor, like fundamentally the hypervisor is technology agnostic, but one of the users is asking about Hyper-V support from the Unidesk product.
I don't have a time for that. It's actually the next major thing on the list. We're making an architectural change here right now that's going to really even allow for that to run. But we get asked about that all the time. We used to get asked about Zen Server a lot, and that has completely fallen off. We are actually getting pushed from customers asking about Hyper-V and from a couple of our bigger partners really wanting us to do it with Microsoft. So that'll probably happen. I don't have a timeline. Like, it's not going to pop out in July or anything, but it definitely is going to happen.
Is that it would make sense to probably target that for a Hyper-V V3, you know, to work with Hyper-V V3. Yeah. I mean, there's so much buzz around that, and there's so much excitement that, you know, Microsoft is going to get it right this time, and or more right, I guess. Some people are using it now, but...
And is it not a ripe market where, you know, VMware has Composer, Citrix has Provisioning Server, Hyper-V has essentially, you know, they've got some stuff going on with Quest, but it's not got a great adoption. So there's a more of an open market there than there even is with VMware or Citrix.
That's a good point because, So this layering stuff, and we'll get through some of these other questions that people are posting, and feel free to pop more into the chat room if you're listening. Let's take a step back, though, because my first exposure to this concept of layering was from Chetan at Atlantis Computing.
Atlantis.
Let's call it 4 years ago. And Atlantis was talking early on about this layering and how all these layers, you know, different layers could be patched at different levels and then sort of combined into desktops and stuff. And there's a lot of logistical problems with that. And Atlantis since has gone on to not focus on layering, but focus on performance. And Atlantis is doing they're doing fine as a company, but they sort of didn't go after that layering. And I think part of that was because this layering is just complex. Because if you're changing things within layers, like maybe you swap out something at the desktop layer level, and it now has files that conflict with a higher level layer, or user installs something and it writes into their layer, but then the desktop, you know, those components that need to be in the desktop layer that the user couldn't write or didn't persist. So my general fear about layering was that it was an amazing, awesome concept, and I want like crazy for it to work, but I'm just scared that it's too brittle and that the exceptions would add up. And at some point, I'm just like, well, F this. If I would have just gone to persistent desktops in the first place and then had like a SCCM or an Altiris, I wouldn't have to deal with any of this shit in the first place.
Yep. I used to worry about that a lot, too. And actually, it's funny that the guys that wrote it and are you know, one of our kernel engineers and our chief architect and Chris, our CTO, those guys noodled for a long time on the concept of you know, because we stack layers. We're not just like RingCube that goes on top of a block image. We've got layers on top of layers, you know, all the way up to the personalization layer. And they noodled for a long time on all the conflict that could happen, right? And how do we resolve it? And they built stuff internally for layer priorities. You know, we still, when you're creating layers, we still respect MSI rules and all that stuff. So all the stuff people are kind of used to using still works. The interesting thing was they even built in some stuff that administrators can use to change layer priorities. So, you know, what am I going to do when app has DLL1 and this one has DLL2 and this one needs to overwrite that one? So we even put in stuff that users could flip-flop layer priorities if they needed to in the field. The funny thing is, you know, like I said, I've been here 2.5 going on 3 years. I've used it twice in all my time here. And I've probably talked to every customer, you know, demo or production that Unidesk has. And I've got customers, you know, that 1,500, 2,000, 4,000 seats that have never used it. So it's
so
like
when
the
you say the users, I'm sorry, yeah. When you say that users can flip-flop it in the field, do you mean like the administrators or the
administrator,
end users?
The administrator, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, the administrator. So the conflict resolution is really, you're dead on, Brian. It's a big worry. And it's actually really important. You have to have the mechanisms underneath and actually be refining them, right? Because day one, they're not going to be perfect. But be refining them as you go to make sure that the desktop operates kind of as expected. And then we also put in another technology. You know, someone in the list here asked a little bit about RingCube. And I think this is where there's going to be some issues until Citrix works out a bridge between the block level provisioning and the RingCube layer. We also put in a technology that administrators can override things in the personalization layer. So when someone does call up and says, hey, Office stopped working, that's all they know. They don't know that it was the stupid plugin they downloaded or whatever. You know, an administrator checks a box. He looks at that desktop and checks a box and says, okay, override anything that they've done that's conflicted with the Office layer. So DLLs, registry entries, they've overwritten things, whatever, and it essentially overrides that way. We don't do it by default because, hey, they might have installed a plugin that replaces a DLL and it works just fine. So the idea is to be able to repair it when it happens really quick, but the key is the underlying system that allow these layers to merge and, like you said, not step all over each other.
Do those repairs happen on the fly, or is that are there reboots in between?
It depends. Typically, where it's a reboot in between. Yeah, because you know, if they installed something and it overwrote a C program files common blah 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 dot DLL, you know, we're just gonna, and it's a restart is exactly what it is. We call it punch through, where the app is basically punching through anything that the user has done. We eradicate their changes to those DLLs or registry entries, restart the machine, and it's back up to where it was. Now, nothing else they did was lost. The WinRAR they installed, their profile, the, you know, iTunes they have, all that stuff's still there, but just anything directly conflicting with that specific app layer.
Okay.
So would you characterize my fear of layering as sort of not really
unfounded?
Maybe unfounded. Would you? Yeah.
You know what I would care? You know what I would liken it to? I would liken it to the early days of server virtualization, where everybody was worried, what if one server ate up all the resources on the host, right? That was a big sweat. That's why no one wanted to move out of test. That's why you didn't move it out of the labs because, you don't understand. My server really, is there a potential for issues? Sure there is, right? But the underlying hypervisor in that case, you know, they built the scheduling mechanisms and the throttling mechanisms so that if it was only given 2 vCPUs, it could only eat 2 cores and there were 20 other cores in the box, et cetera, et cetera. It's a valid thing to bring forward. If the technology has a way to handle it, then great. Right. I don't think all the technologies have a great way to handle it. I think we have a pretty good way of handling it and we continue to refine it. But it's a valid concern that we feel that we've addressed.
So there's a bunch of questions, and I don't know if you can I don't even know how to ask that. You know, so I see Dan Brinkman and some anonymous people are just asking about sort of Unidesk versus RingCube or AppSense or Wenova and these other kinds of things. I don't know if you can even share any thoughts. I don't want to get into, you know, why one
who's,
is
who's better, who's thumping chest. Yeah.
Yeah, but what I don't know. Well, what does Unidesk do that's really cool?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when we first came out, and you guys even mentioned it, I pushed on user installed apps when we first came out because no one else was doing it, which we can support the user installed apps. But the reason I pushed it was because we wanted a splash. And then you guys mentioned, hey, now you guys are doing, you're getting away from persona, you're more doing apps and stuff. And I think that's the really cool thing is that we handle, you know, the user installed apps and anything the user wants to do, but in the same interface and the same technology, the user doesn't have to go to any place else. He can package or layer his apps and they don't have to learn anything, right? They don't have to learn about isolation or bubbles or do I have to link these two packages, these two bubbles so they can communicate or, oh, I can't install Adobe, the full package because I can't support drivers, right? So that's really been a big thing as of late has really been the application stuff.
And you mentioned earlier that, I mean, fundamentally, there's nothing really preventing your stuff from working in a physical desktop environment, which I could extrapolate out to say if you can make it work in a physical environment, then it could work in sort of any virtual environment, client, hypervisor, streamed OS, any server platform. So if a company wanted to use a Unidesk for sort of all their Windows desktops in their environment, regardless of where those are, that's not there today, but sort of would you call that on the roadmap or would you call that on like the concept of what could happen in the future?
That's the long-term goal today. I mean, when we talk about it, we always talk about, you know, we're in VDI today. You got to make your money somewhere. And that's where the change happens to be. But, you know, the long-term goal would be to do this for desktops too, right? One management platform or interface for the end user that can do physical desktops also. And we get asked a lot about servers. Can you do server OSs? There's nothing technically that would keep us from doing server OSs. We just haven't put the focus on it and put the engineering time in on it. And we're probably not going to.
Imagine user installed apps for servers. The user in this case is like Joe Jr. Admin. okay, let's change topics here because we've got about 7 minutes left. And I want to mention a couple things other I want to talk about today, and I guess I'll first mention as continuation. A lot of the layering conversation we've had today and the challenges with clones and everything is it's a topic that we cover at great length in our upcoming book. So Gabe, Jack, and I sort of put our heads together and are writing the book on desktop virtualization that, frankly, we wanted to write for probably 10 years. And so we... You know, I've written books before, and Ron, of course, books, but all of our old books, and I think, Ron, this is the case for your old books also, and certainly the ones we did together, you know, we were very sort of product-focused. Mm-hmm. We never wrote instruction manuals. We sort of wrote, like, if you're the VMware person at your company or you're the Citrix person, here's what you got to know in order to roll out Citrix or whatever. And those books were huge. They were, like, $60 or $70 to buy, and they were 900 pages, and, you know, they were insane. So what we're writing right now is a book sort of on the whole concept of desktop virtualization and why it didn't take off like everyone thought it would and what you can really do about it and how to think about VDI versus client hypervisors and applications as a service and Windows future apps and web apps and all that sort of stuff. And this is the book that I'm actually going to go home after this and hopefully we'll finish writing this thing today. But I think it'll be available on Amazon in the Kindle form in the next couple of weeks.
Sweet.
It'll be like 200 pages instead of 900 pages. So I think we'll be able to hit like the $10 price point on Kindle. Probably we'll do like as a hardcover, sell for like $25 in paper form. Our working title, I was asking on Twitter earlier if anyone saw, our working title is either called The VDI Delusion or possibly The VDI Fallacy.
You guys are haters. You're VDI and Microsoft haters.
Well, and so, you know, if you look at, so the VDI delusion is cool, but, you know, Richard Dawkins wrote that sort of pro-atheism book called The God Delusion, and I don't want people to sort of be mad at me because they don't, you know, like, I don't want to, like, bring any religion correlation into this. And, you know, but if you look at the definition of fallacy, it's the definition literally says it's a mistaken belief, especially one based on unsound arguments. So I feel like...
So when I heard delusion, I did not think for one second that it had anything to do with religion or the God fallacy or anything like or delusion or anything like that. Now, fallacy, on the other hand,
different word.
The first syllable of
different
that.
Different word, different spelling.
It's the first syllable that gets me to hung up on that one.
So delusion is an idiosyncratic belief or impression that is firmly maintained despite being contradicted by what is generally accepted as reality or rational arguments.
So if we put that definition on the first page too, I think we're good.
But in this, I think the subtitle will be something like Why Desktop Virtualization Failed to Live Up to the Hype and What the Future Enterprise Desktop Will Really Look Like. So this is great because we do get into why... and what did that Risk On, Risk Off tweeted? Like, the title should be called like the VDI Delusion, how one company like flim-flammed an entire install base into buying shelfware or something like that. And, you know, we do open up and, like, I mean, it's pretty critical of VMware early on, like, that... how they were successful with server virtualization and why, and then how they tried to equate that to desktop virtualization and how Citrix got involved, and then like the reality of VDI where it didn't live up to the hype, and we get into our cost analysis and, like, you know, how to lie with cost models, and we do talk about where VDI works and where desktop virtualization works, because it's certainly, you know, I'm a big hater of VDI when it's tried to be pushed into scenarios where it doesn't make sense. Which means that people hate VDI when really it's like they should hate the person who recommended it because it didn't work. And I point out we do have, 5 or 10 million VDI users in the world who are all loving it. So there's certainly a use case. It's just not, you know, we're not turning all of our users into VDI users. And then we get into the future of Windows applications and app stores and all these alternative apps, device native. I mean, I think it's a fun book. And we kind of split the writing duties. So I wrote a bunch of chapters. Jack wrote some chapters. Gabe wrote some chapters. We're sort of stitching it all together now. But regard the VDI delusion, the VDI fallacy, look for it. It'll be Kindle, hopefully, in the next couple weeks. And cool. Books, you know, on Amazon, I guess, probably in another end of the month.
You guys are bringing Jack right along, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Bringing him along, huh?
Yeah, and for this, I mean, for this book, it's great too because there's a lot that he's able to contribute, even really only focusing on the space for it's been 6 months, I guess. But like Jack wrote the entire chapter that's about these other non-Windows application platforms. So how you deal with all these native apps in, well, I don't know, you know, iOS and web apps and all that.
All the things that these punk kids do.
like Jack. And it, you know, it's really hard. The challenge with Jack is giving him 15 years of accrued cynicism in such a short period of time. And I think he's taken to it well with the Microsoft stuff, at least.
Well, and now, I mean, and especially, you know, and I think I mentioned this before, but we brought in Jack around the time that we sort of formally launched our consumerization efforts. And I would argue now that Jack knows more about MDM and mobile app management than I do. And he's actually doing expert video casts for us now. And people are asking for him, not me, because Jack's writing. He's writing 3 articles a week on consumerized IT, and I'm writing like once every 2 weeks on that site or whatever. So, yeah, it's working out well so far. So that I wanted to get that out there. And a lot of stuff we talk about is in that book. So I'm really – this is the book I'm actually most proud of. Well, I should maybe take that back. I don't want to say that. But this is a book that it's cool because it has like my most knowledge of the industry in it, you know, as opposed to, it's not like a product guide. It's not product specific. Probably the words Zen app and Vue are only mentioned a half a dozen times in the entire book. It's more about sort of the how you deal with this technology and how you think about delivering Windows desktops in your environment.
See, we had a suggestion from Dan Brinkman for VDI pound fail, which is which was the title idea that I was going for, but.
Yeah, I Jack wants it to be called VDI.
Oh, then Anon 3186 yawn.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking. Because to me, like, if you call it the VDI delusion or the VDI fallacy, like, that makes a statement. And VDI fail makes it sound too, like, trivial, like the punk kid FML kind of, you know, first world problem kind of thing. I don't know. So we'll kind of see where we end up with that. The other thing I wanted to mention is, so we've been talking on Twitter this morning about Noah Wasmer, leaving VMware. And so Noah, we've mentioned him before. He's been on podcasts before and videos we've done. Noah was an old school terminal services person from 10 years ago. He joined VMware, went into their Vue group, and then he's the guy who sort of created this concept of VMware Horizon, which is their platform that and product and service that will tie together web apps and web app provisioning and consumer apps and Windows apps and everything. And VMware's going big. I feel like VMware's almost like dropping Vue from their sexy list and replacing it with Horizon. And Citrix is doing this too with what they call their cloud gateway, and I think what Centrix does this, and there's Quest is going down this path. So, but he's Mr. Horizon for VMware. But it was announced, by the way, actually, the way I found out he left VMware, and I'll give a shout out to this website. It's called Nimble. Shit, I just forgot right now. Let me look. NIMBIL. So it's this. Yeah, it's called like the social CRM platform. I just use a free version. You give it access to your LinkedIn account and Twitter, and like you can log into your email if you want to, and it mines all that for data. And for me, it sends the best feature on it, and this is what I use is free, is it sends you an email each day with all your LinkedIn contacts who changed jobs every day. So it's like, please congratulate the following five people. And like today, it's like Noah Wassmer, like VP products at MobileIron. And I'm like, oh, holy shit. So... we know it's public because it's on his LinkedIn profile. And so, so I tweeted about that, and a bunch of people have been sort of retweeting and saying, it's a loss for VMware and everything. So he's taken this week off. He's a recent and proud father. So he's taking this week off, and he starts at MobileIron officially next week. But I said, hey, man, give me a soundbite for our show as to what why you're leaving VMware. And as a matter of fact, I actually just got this email during the show, so I haven't even read it yet. So here's what he says. I loved my 5 years at VMware. I have to magnify this. I can't see. I loved my 5 years at VMware.
Make sure at the end of the email it doesn't say, oh, by the way, don't mention this on the air.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Pre-read.
I loved my 5 years at VMware. I think VMware is going to drive some amazing innovation this year around a new way of working. For me, the fastest, most aggressive, and exciting changes are in mobile IT, iOS, Android, and even Windows on ARM. Parentheses, we can debate the enterprise use case. MobileIron is blazing a new ground in the space, and I'm thrilled to be coming on board. That's a good VP-level statement of non-information. Love VMware. This is exciting, blah, blah. So he'll be back from vacation next week, so maybe we can try and pull him in.
And I guess we have another MDM company to add to the list, right?
Yep, they're on the list already, aren't they? Yeah, MobileIron, I think, is tearing it up. People say good things about them. So, all right, I think that's about. We are like a little bit over our hour now. I don't know if anyone else has any final thoughts or anything for today.
Not really. Glad Ron could join us.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, Ron, I really appreciate it. We'd love to see you at Bri Forum in London, and we can make some special provisions for you. Otherwise, hopefully we'll see you in Chicago, your hometown, and I assume where you're connecting from today?
Yep, sitting out in the basement bunker.
Nice. Well,
I'm sure that it is a bunker.
Yeah, I've got reinforced walls in my office, at least.
and room for your whole family. So on that note, Ron Oglesby, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. Gabe, thank you for joining. Jack, thank you. And all of you, thank you for listening. And we will see you all. Well, here you can listen to us next week, same time, right here. Thanks a lot.